Welcome to Radio Physics, a collaboration with the Aspen Center for Physics, KDNK Community Radio in Carbondale, and advanced physics students from Roaring Fork Valley High Schools. The students spend a week working at the center during the summer and get to talk one-on-one to some of the distinguished physicists who are here. I'm Patty Fox, and I'm hosting today's program, which was recorded during the teen summer program at the Aspen Center for Physics. With me today is Professor Randall G. Hewlett, an experimental atomic physicist and director of the Atom Cooling Group at Rice University. He'll be interviewed by Roger Ramos from Basalt High School and a guest gopher, Asta Sigurdsson, daughter of a participating physicist who is here at the center. Professor Hewlett received his undergraduate degree from Stanford and his PhD from MIT. His research group at Rice investigates atoms at temperatures as low as a few nanokelvin because at such low temperatures the strange and fascinating effects of quantum mechanics dominate, greatly altering normal atomic behavior. Today's interview will concentrate on how the Hewlett group is using these cold atoms to understand high temperature conductivity.
Superconductivity.
So first off, what is cold atom research?
All right. Cold atoms is a field of physics where we use lasers to slow and therefore cool atoms to temperatures of just a few degrees above absolute zero, or just a few nanodegrees above absolute zero. So it's the coldest thing that's ever produced, been produced ever in the history of the universe, and coldest thing that we have on Earth.
Can you explain the importance of what you're studying and how does it affect us every day?
What I'm doing is very fundamental physics, and so that's a really difficult question to answer, but it's a question that I have to answer because my funding depends on it. So ultra-cold atom physics is a study of atoms, collections of atoms that are at such low temperatures that they behave in unison or coherently, we say. And you can think of the difference between acoustic noise, you know, just loud noises that maybe don't add up to anything special, as opposed to a single musical note. A single musical note is what happens when you get atoms at temperatures that are so low that they begin to behave coherently. And so they're like a single wavelength. Now, this is exactly the same conditions that we need to produce something called superconductivity, which is, in effect, that allows electricity to propagate through wires without any loss, without any heat. And so the practical implications of that are enormous. And so we want to ultimately understand superconductivity better and in a deep theoretical way in order to produce better technological devices.
And does this have any tie-in with the Bose-Einstein condensate?
Yes, exactly. So the Bose-Einstein condensate is the pure musical note of an atom wave. The Bose-Einstein condensate is where every atom in this gas is in a collective state. It's all in the same state. And so we think of that like just like a wavelength of sound where you have the sound in one single note. Here we have the atoms in one single wave.
How do you use cold atoms to understand high temperature superconductivity?
You ask difficult questions. That's a great question. Again, it's a very much removed from the actual superconductors. So to conduct electricity, we need charges. So we need electrons in particular. And so the electronic materials that conduct electricity work by having some kind of zero resistance flow of those electrons. Now, what we do in cold atom physics is to use the cold atoms as stand-ins for the electrons. So atoms are, compared to an electron, are very massive. And so in order to have the same kind of quantum mechanical behavior of atoms as electrons, we have to go to extraordinarily low temperatures. and hence why we have to go to temperatures that are nano Kelvin or billionths of a degree above absolute zero. So if we can make a simulation of a real electronic material that superconducts, we can better understand it because we can better control the atoms than we can the electrons.
And how does this tie in with what you're working on right now?
Yeah, so my real interest right now is magnetism, because it turns out that there are certain classes of superconductors, they're called the high-temperature superconductors, that were discovered about 30 years ago. We still don't know how they work. It's a little bit embarrassing for a physicist to say that we made a discovery that's 30 years old and we don't know how it works. And so this is our motivation. And so it turns out that those materials all show magnetic effects. Magnetism is where the spin of, which is an inherent property of the electron, but also of an atom, where that spin is interacting with other spins, and that's called magnetism. And it turns out that almost all of the high temperature superconducting materials are also magnetic or antiferromagnetic. And antiferromagnetic, instead of all the spins pointing in the same direction, it's more like a checkerboard, and they alternate, spin up, spin down, spin up, spin down. And we've recently seen that antiferromagnetic state in a state of cold atoms.
How exactly did you become like interested in something like this?
Something like recently, how I got interested in this topic?
Yeah.
Or more in general, how I got interested in physics?
More in general, like how did you become interested in physics?
Okay, that's a really important question, especially for young people. I was good at it. And I wasn't so good at some other things. And so that's always a good guide. The things that you're best at, you should pay attention to. And the things that you like to do, you should pay attention to. And so when I was a kid, I liked mathematics. But I also liked to play around with lawnmower engines. And later in life with motorcycle engines. And so I spent a lot of time tinkering with things. And for an experimental physicist, tinkering is kind of what we do professionally. And so that was really good practice for me, or good preparation for me to be an experimental physicist. But getting back to your question, for me, I had a role model. My father was a chemist, and I really I saw what he did day to day, and he seemed like he was having a great time, that he really enjoyed it. And the lifestyle of a scientist is very appealing because you get to choose what you work on, and people don't tell you what to do. You get to develop your own plan, which has its upsides and its downsides. If you develop your own plan, you're also responsible for seeing it work, and you have to raise the money for it. And so those, you know, maybe the harder aspects of that, but it's nice to be in control of your own destiny. So being a scientist is kind of the ultimate in freedom in terms of getting to do what you want to do. And so I love doing it. I love being a scientist. I feel like I'm very lucky to have kind of fallen into it. But I guess, you know, as a young person, the advice I would give is that people pay attention to what they're good at and what they love to do, and try to figure out how you can make a living doing those things.
Also, being a scientist, we know there's like lots of troubles, and sometimes you hit like that wall. Does that ever happen to you?
I'm continually at the wall, banging my head against it. Yeah, being a scientist can also be frustrating because nature doesn't give up its secrets willingly, and you have to work hard. And so you keep pushing and pushing on something, and it pushes back, and you find that you spent the last 2 years going the wrong direction. You have to back up. And so that happens all the time. And the times when you, it makes all the times that you do break through and you do discover something new all the more special. There's a lot of hard work and effort of a lot of people went into it.
So this is like a little off topic, but do you think super solidity exists?
First, let me define what a super solid is. So a super solid is something which is both a superconductor or a superfluid, or something that can flow without resistance, but also has some kind of structure, like a crystal structure. And that's a pretty deep question, and I don't know if I can answer it with the level of
yes or no
detail. So yeah, if you want a yes or no answer, I would say yes. But it remains, I can be proven wrong very easily, of course.
Like you were talking about superfluidity, like what does it act like most of the time? And how does it kind of tie into your work?
All right, so a superconductor, superconductors have been known for more than 100 years. And they were discovered when a Dutch physicist named Kamerlingh Onnes was able to liquefy helium. And so that occurs at about 4 degrees Kelvin, 4 degrees above absolute zero. And so when he accomplished that, he immediately started doing things like measuring the resistances of various metals. And one of the metals that he looked at was mercury. And mercury had this, he discovered this very strange property that when it got cool, when it was cool below about 10 degrees, it suddenly lost all resistance. And nobody could understand this, but subsequently a number of other metals were discovered to be superconductors. And it wasn't really explained until the 1940s. It took that long to really understand it. But it, again, is this kind of coherent property of electrons traveling in a wave, that they can travel through the wire without knocking into each other. And so that effect has intrigued physicists for 100 years. And it really drives my work, because I want to understand how that behavior comes about on a more detailed level.
You're listening to KDNK Community Radio. This is Radio Physics, a collaboration of KDNK and the Aspen Center for Physics, with high schoolers interviewing visiting physicists. Today's physicist is Randy Hewlett from Rice University. He's being interviewed by Asta Sigurdsson and Roger Ramos from Basalt High School. I'm Patty Fox, and we'll continue now with Roger.
I feel bad for this, but I'm going to ask you about something that happened a couple of years ago, the Borromean rings, and sort of like what happened, because when you look it up on the internet, it says you proved a 40-year-old theory to be correct.
So I'm not sure why you feel bad about asking me about that one. This is a pretty esoteric topic, but it has to do with binding of three atoms. It's nothing to do with superconductivity, but it has to do with binding of three atoms into a molecule. And there was a prediction made by a man, Vitaly Afrimov, many years ago, I guess about 30 years ago. And it was a very strange prediction, because it predicted that these three particles could be bound, three atoms could be bound into a molecule in a regime where two atoms could not. And then, when you think about it, that's a very weird thing. But there are these Borromean rings that date back to the 16th century. It was the coat of arms of a family in Lake Maggiore, which is in northern Italy, where there are three islands. And the three islands were part of the family's domain. And the three islands, they had the symbol, three interlocking rings. They look a little bit like the Olympic rings, except the three interlock together in such a way that if you were to remove one of the rings or one of the islands, the other two would fall. And so it's this analogy, these Borromean rings is an analogy of being able to bind together three atoms into a molecule where two of them cannot be stable or not be bound. And so it goes, this is an analogy with these Borromean rings. If you Google that term, Borromean, Borromean,
nice.
You Google that, you'll find all kinds of neat symbols of it. It turns out there's a beer that has Borromean rings as its logo. There are many different. There's a chapel in Florence that has Borromean rings on the gate. It's a very interesting subject.
You do a lot of different stuff that they relate, but they don't always. So what would you say interests you the most?
We do a kind of a spectrum of physics, from the kinds of things that Roger just asked about the Borromean rings and the triatomic molecules, to more many-body kinds of physics. And I would have to say that right now I'm most interested in the many-body physics, because we figured out a way of making collections of atoms even colder. And it may seem funny that we're trying to get even lower temperatures, but in physics, whenever you develop a new tool, you develop new capabilities to do new things, to be able to see new phenomena. And so we've developed a new tool to go even lower temperatures, to go to tens of nanokelvin instead of 100 nanokelvin. And those lower temperatures are enabling us to see new things about quantum magnetism that we haven't seen before. So I'm most excited about that right now.
Can you define many body?
Yeah, many body is more than three. Okay. So when you think about a glass of water, there are maybe 10 to the 24 water molecules in that glass. And so that's definitely a many body system. When you're thinking about a superconducting wire, we are also thinking about 10 to the 24, so a 10 with 24 zeros after it, electrons in that wire. And so systems behave, when you have the physics of the behavior of these systems that contain so many particles, is called many-body physics. You can't understand many-body physics from single-particle physics, because the interactions that go on in the many-particle system. So many-body physics includes the study of what we call condensed matter, so liquids and solids, but also gases.
So you said that you found a way to make the atoms colder. What are you hoping that the superconductors will help you with in the future?
So we've seen the magnetism that exists, this antiferromagnetism that we've seen in high-temperature superconductors. We've been able to see that now with cold atoms, but only because we were able to get cold enough. And as I mentioned before, the temperature scales of cold that you need with cold atoms to achieve these kinds of phenomena are so much lower than they are with the real superconductors, we have to use completely different techniques. So in superconductivity, getting to 10 degrees or 100 degrees Kelvin is a matter of liquefying helium or nitrogen to make some wire very cold. But in cold gas physics, cold atom physics, we have to cool these gases of atoms to temperatures that are more than a million times colder. And so we have completely different experimental techniques. So we have techniques where we can trap and confine atoms, hold them away from contact with anything that has any heat. So in our laboratories, we have a vacuum chamber where there is nothing in the vacuum chamber except these atoms of lithium, in our case. They could be rubidium or potassium. But in our lab, there are atoms of lithium that we trap in some configuration of magnetic fields and laser beams. And so they're kind of suspended in space. So if you peer into this chamber, which is otherwise empty, you see nothing but the glow of these atoms sitting in the center of the trap.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really fun to see. It's really something that, that's visual. You know, you can walk into a lab and you can show somebody and say, hey, that's a gas, which is a millionth of a degree above absolute zero. And most people have never seen that before.
In 2011, you received an award for pioneering studies of ultracold Bose and Fermi systems. Can you explain some of that?
That award was given for our experimental work with ultracold atoms, using lithium atoms, as I mentioned. So lithium atoms comes in two different flavors. So there's lithium-7, which is called an isotope. Lithium-7 is got one more neutron than lithium-6. So the nucleus of the lithium atom consists of three protons and then some number of neutrons. And lithium-6 has three, and lithium-7 has four neutrons. And that difference makes the difference between whether lithium-7 becomes a boson and lithium-6 becomes a fermion. And a boson and fermion behave differently at low temperatures. In one case, the bosons undergo a kind of coalescence or condensation into a Bose-Einstein condensate, which is what we talked before, which is a single wavelength of atoms. Fermions are very different, and the fermions are what electrons are. And so fermions are kind of antisocial. They don't like to get close to each other. And there's something called a Pauli exclusion principle that says the two identical fermions can't be in the same place at the same time. And so that's very different than the bosons. And so our work with many body physics and superconductivity is done with Fermi gases, lithium-6, whereas our work with Bose-Einstein condensates is done with lithium-7.
Okay, so earlier you mentioned how you were hoping that in the future you could use like some of the cold atoms to create like more technology and like have more technology advances. So what exactly did you mean by that?
Well, in science, there's a whole sequence of kinds of science that go into some. If you look at some technological advance, let's say the laser. So the laser was invented, I guess, before you guys were born, but not before I was born. And during that time, the public sees the product. We see the laser. But we don't see the decades, or in this case, maybe 50 years of basic science that went into understanding what we needed to know to make the laser. And the same goes with the transistor. And the same goes with the GPS system. So there are many, many examples where there are just decades of basic science of learning what are the laws and rules of nature. You know, how does Mother Nature govern how collections of atoms or electrons behave under certain circumstances, maybe in one dimension or in two dimensions? We have to learn all of those things before we can sit down and invent a device. So the invention really relies on a whole mountain of scientific knowledge that has to be developed before the invention can ever be conceived of. And so our work is really at that far end of that spectrum. So we're not inventing devices, but we're learning new laws of nature. And we hope then other people in the future will take that and be able to invent things, for example, a new type of superconductor that maybe works at room temperature. So imagine if you had a superconductor that was a material that superconducted at room temperature. If you had such a thing, you could transmit electricity through power lines that had no losses. We wouldn't lose the electricity that we now lose from heat, from the conductivity of copper wires. So it turns out that's like 30% of all electricity which is produced is lost. by the heat in the resistivity of the copper wire. Now, if we had a superconductor to replace that copper wire, we wouldn't have that that loss. And so ultimately what we hope is that the work that we do as physicists will be used maybe a long time from now, but eventually be used to make better devices and to help our, you know, help mankind in some technological way.
Thank you so very much, Randy Hewlett from Rice University, Asta Sigurdsson, and Roger Ramos from Basalt High School, for participating in Radio Physics.